On this episode, we talk to web designer and developer Jonathan Snook.
Going from freelancing to the man, back to freelancing, and the strength of women in tech.
Thunder! 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 Thunder!
Welcome to the Thunder Nerds, where we can learn to live with the wildlings or we can add them to the army of the dead. I am now and forever JD Riot.
And I am Frederick Philip Von Weiss, and you are listening to the Thunder Nerds, a design and developer discussion for all levels of people and industry that simply love what they do and do web good. Oh, the wildlings. Is it cold? Is winter coming?
Well, listen, I figured it was particular because our guest is from north of the wall.
That's right, he is. We have a very special guest from north of the wall today. We have web designer and developer Jonathan Snook. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. Although, let it be known, I actually came across the border just for this podcast.
They didn't let him through. The wildlings have to sneak over to steal things.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they've got, you know, it's hard to grow stuff up there, man. Well, times are tough.
Yeah, oh, the moment you cross the border, it's all ice and snow. It's horrible up there.
I don't know. That sounds kind of nice to me. We're in Florida, so it's blazing hot. So
it's always the grass is greener on the other side because I have grown very tired of winter, and I am looking forward to some hot, muggy weather.
I think maybe if I had some seasons, I might be more likely to agree with you, because do you have like a slight
Every
bit of
time.
Summer?
Yeah, actually, summer's not too bad. We only get about maybe 2 weeks of really hot weather. Otherwise,
in June.
Like July and August, we get that hot, muggy weather. And then we got the sort of early summer, early fall, where it's pleasant. It's just really nice. And then for the other 6 months, it's winter.
Yeah, and it is truly winter too. I used to live up in North Dakota, which was about an hour away from the border where I was. So we'd go up there quite frequently. But it's just like they have snow, melted snow that's become ice, fresh snow on top of that, and then eventually for 2 weeks they have what they like to call the no snow period. That's crazy.
Can we start off by talking a little bit about your career history and
Absolutely.
A little bit about what you do?
So I guess, what do I do? I'm a web designer and developer. I make stuff on the web. I make stuff with the web. I like the web, HTML, CSS, JavaScript. They're technologies that feel very comfortable to me and have kind of stuck with that for most of my career.
Consider yourself then more of a designer or a mixture of all the disciplines?
I definitely consider myself a mix of all the disciplines. It's definitely like my background. I started off as a back-end developer. That was sort of my initial career when I first got into web development. Mm-hmm. But had opportunities to do some front-end development and front-end design, where, you know, we had designers that built wonderful marketing sites, and then we had these administration tools to manage those sites. And that administration, for the most part, the designer's like, we don't care. Like, nobody's actually going to see that except for the client. And so I would actually go in and do the design work. I wanted this to be functional. I wanted it to be easy. I mean, these are tools that people needed to use to manage their websites, and I wanted them to be functional. I didn't want them to be crap and difficult to use, and therefore I kind of honed some of my initial design skills through building a lot of that kind of stuff. And then I went freelance for about 5 years, and throughout that time really had the opportunity to engage with clients and say, okay, you know, I can do the everything from the initial wireframes to the UI architecture to the application architecture, and then get into the design, get into the front-end development, get into the back-end development, and just, you know, own the entire workflow, or even just a part of the workflow. You know, I might come in and just do one little piece. And one of the things I really enjoyed about freelance and working for myself was having that opportunity to pick and choose the projects that I wanted to work on and pick and choose the technologies and the facets of web development that really appealed to me at that time.
So what led you to go from freelance back to the man then?
Having a regular paycheck. Yep. You know, as
I mean, I knew the answer to the question. I just wanted to ask it anyway. It's like, what was the
there is
about how long in were you like, you know, the freelance freedom fighter, you know, when you were like, you know what, man, I really, really miss the grind of this. I mean, did it take you years, months?
It was definitely years. I don't mind freelancing. It really was a cash flow issue. At the sort of the end of my freelance career, unfortunately, I went through separation and subsequently divorce, and therefore I no longer had that second salary to ease out the cash flow. You know, those rough months where it might take me 2 months to get paid for a project. You know, I needed cash flow, and since, you know, I was newly single, I needed a regular income, and that really kind of forced me to get a regular job, regular paycheck to keep.
I believe they call that dating money.
Dates cost money.
Dates do cost money. Uh-huh. Yes, they do.
What restaurant are we going to? Carrabba's? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, exactly.
We're going to
what restaurant
tonight.
Are we going to? Restaurant. I was like, girl, you can pick whatever Happy Meal you want. You can supersize that, girl. Damn, but that's not that's not relevant anymore. Can you think about that? Supersizing isn't fucking relevant anymore, and it hasn't been relevant for like 10 years. Oh, my God, kids are horrible. This is sad.
Time goes by like that. Jonathan, would you say, too, there's value in not freelancing for a certain period in your career? And what I mean by that, finding companies that you could align yourself with. In your career, you went from Yahoo, Shopify, those are big companies that you could connect your brand with. And I believe companies like that are things that people look for. Is it more you freelance to get to that level? You work at a company like that for a little while, and then you go back to freelancing because you have that freelance career?
Going into it, I didn't have those expectations of like, this is something that's going to further my career, but it absolutely did. It was a nice side effect, and it was a really good opportunity to experience and grow with a product, which is something that I never had the opportunity to do as a freelancer, because I would work on a project, I deliver it, the client manages it after that, and I would never see it again unless, you know, the client came back a year later and said, hey, we'd like some more stuff added to this. So I didn't get that opportunity to really, you know, foster a product, and that both at Yahoo and at Shopify, and after that at Xero, having an opportunity to really be engaged with developing the product was hugely beneficial to, you know, really learn how to make that a success. And so I thoroughly enjoyed my time at all those places.
You pick up a lot from those companies as far as their set of distinct directives and expectations, and you could bring that with you in your career.
Opposite side of the coin too. Like you can pick and choose what you don't want to take with you. Like, which I think is more times than not the case. Like you'll find, if you have an objective mind, you'll find the things that you don't want to take, or the things that you like but you want to adapt. Which I think is another thing that is important to think about if you're going into a job. Like, don't just definitively be like, ah, fuck this, I hate it, or oh, this is amazing, this is exactly perfect. Look and start tinkering with some ideas, and it doesn't hurt to be that guy in the office that talks about tinkering with the ideas. I mean, well, sometimes it can be, but usually that gets you noticed.
Oh yeah, well, so throughout my career, there's definitely been things that I've been able to pull out of each job. I mean, when I first got into web development, I worked for local web agencies doing mostly government work, some private sector work. but these companies were very small, so you had to wear many hats, and it meant things like being involved in sales pitches, being involved in proposal writing, being involved in budgeting. And that was, I mean, when I went to go freelance, all of those skills were hugely beneficial. And then when I, you know, went to work at Yahoo, okay, well, now I had to worry about how to scale with multiple teams, you know, now dealing with dozens, if not hundreds of people working on the same product. How do you manage distributed teams across multiple offices? And I found like I can bring those skills from one company to the next, you know, coming into Shopify, which at the time was fairly small considering, you know, I was employee number 93. And then, you know, 4 years later, they're well over 1,000 people. So that kind of growth, how do you scale that kind of team? How do you make sure that the right people with the right skills are in the right place? But also then from just, you know, what do I look for in the kind of businesses that I like to work in? So at Yahoo, when I first got there, I enjoyed the product that we were building. I thought that we were, you know, making good mail products, calendar, like all these just the good communication suite and understanding how these things engage the user, seeing all the user testing that they did was a fantastic experience. And but near the end of that, it was around the time when they were going through a lot of CEOs. And then the drive for revenue as opposed to the drive for a good user experience, and realizing that that business model, that sort of ad-driven business model, wasn't one that I particularly cared for, that I particularly engaged with. And so going to work at Shopify was the sort of flip side to this. I liked the fact that Shopify had a different business model, one that said, okay, we build a good product, people will pay for that product, as opposed to we will build a good product so that we can get people, so that we can get advertisers to pitch to them, which I think changes the dynamic of what kind of experience you create for your users. And I like that. And when I decided to go to Xero, I went to Xero because, again, you know, having learned what I had from Yahoo, I liked the business model that they were in. And so when I think about, okay, what direction do I want to take? If I was ever to work on my own product, what path do I want to take it in? You know, do I want to be ad-driven, or do I want to be more product-driven where customers pay for the product? And so I want to try to align myself with those goals. And so that's been a great learning experience.
Probably if you have some kind of company that's either looking to drive their quality of the product by user experience, or they're looking to drive Q3 sales. There's a few different schools of thought, and I don't know if one's right or one's wrong. It seems that one is right and one is wrong, but I guess it depends on the situation and the company.
I think it does. I mean, when we say, like, you know, driving Q3 sales, and I think a lot of that sometimes has to do with whether the company's public or not. And that's also a different dynamic that's not necessarily locked down to whether it's ad-driven or what I want to call product-driven, where, you know, the sort of revenue-driven model. Because, you know, even a product company like Shopify, now I'm not saying that this is the kind of company they are now, but could very well be driven by quarterly results. Like, you know, we see a lot of public companies that may have a solid business model be driven by quarterly results. And, so, you know, a lot of it comes down to where is the incentive for the kind of work that they're doing. And, you know, if I were ever to run my own company that got to that size, would I always be aligned with what I think is the right decision? And I saw that at Yahoo, where, you know, if you see a business decision being made and it's worth millions of dollars, you're like, that's a really hard number to turn down. And some people can do it and some people can't. So I honestly don't know. And again, I don't think that, you know, like you guys said, it's not a right thing or wrong thing. It's just a different thing. And it's just whatever I think different people are going to feel comfortable with.
It's hard to say what's right and wrong there. It's just the kind of business. You have to think about your own value in going to these companies. It's not about you getting a job. It's about them hiring you. And when I say you, I mean anybody. Making sure that when you apply to some company, you're not just going there for a paycheck, but you're looking at a company that's hiring you and your skills, your services, and take your value in consideration and what you could bring to the table. So if one of those polarizing models doesn't fit with what you want to do as far as your career path, you should really take that into consideration.
Yeah, I think that's something that we learn with age. It's hard going into an organization, kind of having a small idea of what the company does, how they interact, what that internal culture is like. And sometimes you just have to jump in and see whether or not that meshes with the kind of person you are. There's so many different facets to what people look for out of a job. And for some people, having a 9-to-5 job without any consideration for the stuff that happens, after hours, some people really want that. I have a lot of friends that do that, where it's all about the 9-to-5, and they live for the weekends to do their own thing, and that's perfectly fine for them. Whereas for me, I feel like I want something that when I go to work, I'm excited about. I really want to be excited about the stuff that I'm working on.
Well, it's a difference between people renting a space and people owning, being an owner of a business. There's nothing wrong with having those people, because you have to have those bodies to throw at it. And it's not to say that they're not passionate when they're in there, but you can definitely tell it's people who aren't doing what they honestly love, or they're not doing what they honestly love the way that they're going to honestly be in love with it. Not everybody gets to find that. I think it's like a slim majority of people who really, like you, who have found it. You're like, this is my perfect Sunday. This is what I want. This is what I wake up and think about. So I think it's rare. I think it does come with age. And Fred, what you were talking about with, not making it be about a paycheck, and with, what Jonathan said about talking about it coming with age, I think that just translates into the word planning.
You have to have your career in your mind as you owning your own business, your business being you and what you do and what kind of company you want to align yourself with, as far as, do I want that 9-to-5 so I could go out on the weekends and kayak? Do I want some place where I could really invest my time because I believe in what they're doing?
Yeah, those kinds of things, like leading a team, can be really difficult for me because of the kind of personality that I have versus the different personalities on the team and what people want. I tend to be, when I say this, it comes across maybe negatively, but a bit of a loner in that, like, I don't do a lot of work extracurricular activities. I might be passionate about the work that I'm doing, but at the end of the day, I'm going to go home and do my own thing. Whereas a lot of people like the team camaraderie. They want to be able to go for drinks after work. They want to have that sort of team click where they go for lunch together. And a lot of people love that environment. Whereas for me, I tend to, when I go for lunch, I pick a different person to have lunch with. I want to hear what other people are doing within the company. And again, there's no right or wrong there, but it's interesting to try to build a team with so many different personalities, things that different people want from the team, and maintain that balance between everybody. And so, there is that on the microcosm of a single team, but there's also that on the macro level within an entire organization. And it's a lot of work to try to make something that works well, and have a well-run company where everybody's happy.
Sure, because you have micro communication where people might take a text the wrong way because you didn't go out to lunch with them on Thursday and maybe have a beer after work. So there's that. And those little things that might sound goofy, but it could be something that leads to some kind of important decision. So, Jonathan, are you having time to still write now that you're doing more freelance? Are you, you've written for A List Apart, 24 Ways, Dot Magazine. You've co-authored two books. I believe you're still writing a lot. Are you finding the time to do that? Is it easier now? Is it harder now?
It definitely slowed down for a while. I I used writing, especially for my blog, as an opportunity to just get the ideas and thoughts out of my head and write them down and just figure out, okay, like, what am I running into? Is this like a bug that, you know, is it an actual bug? Then let me test in all the different browsers and then write up my experience on that. And then, you know, during my freelance years, I knew that writing for, you know, other organizations was an attempt to get my name out there, to get that visibility. So to write for Allistapart or .NET Mag, you know, that opportunity for people to see my expertise put out there so that I could continue to get work. And I think that worked really well for me. But I definitely ran into a period over the last, I want to say 2 years, where I had a tough time writing. I was no longer writing for me, and I had a tough time getting the thoughts out there in a coherent, cohesive manner. And as a result, I didn't do a whole lot of writing for a couple of years. And it's only been since the beginning of this year that I've tried to make a habit of writing more often. And as a result of that, things are starting to pick up. And now that I'm going back to freelance, my intention is to actually write a lot more. So I'm hoping that over the course of this year, you know, I'd love to have a rewrite of my book, Smacks, Scalable and Modular Architecture for CSS. So I want a second edition out there. By the end of summer, and then I have some other books out there as well that I want to write and put out into the world.
I now know why you're a loner. The writing thing for me. Like, I'm the same way. Like, there are very few people that I want to hang out with, that I force myself to hang out with, or some people that it's like it's easy to hang out with. Like, I've got Fred and I've got my other best friend, and so that's where it's so simple. But like, writing is really my favorite thing in the world to do. Like, I would do it nonstop all day, every day. I think that's one of the qualities of like a loner, somebody who's okay with themselves, happy inside their own head, and it's like a creative forge that you have to sometimes just get out.
I think that's a good way to put it.
Speaking about Smacks and writing a second edition, which I didn't know you were thinking about. That's pretty cool. I remember that's all I heard about for like months. Like, have you read Jonathan Snook's book on Smacks, and downloading the PDF and reading about that, and then looking at other things that kind of came out, BAM and things like that, that kind of followed in the footsteps. Do you believe that helped your career out a little bit?
But I think there are a number of moments in my career that have helped add visibility. And that particular book was one of them. And it's definitely something that I've been riding the coattails of for the last 4 years, coming up on 5 years now since I first wrote the book. And I mean, I'm blown away by how successful it's been. I'm grateful that it's resonated with a lot of people. And, you know, I mean, over 5 years, to have a concept that I think is still applicable is great. You know, for anybody within this industry, most technical books become irrelevant within a year because the technology changes so quickly. This book was different in that it was mostly a higher level thinking, that there wasn't a lot of books. In fact, there isn't really a whole lot of books in this vein out there, which I think has been surprising. Like, I would have expected over 5 years that we would see, you know, books on object-oriented CSS, books on BEM, that there would be other people talking about CSS architecture at this level, because I don't think this is the only way to do it. There are definitely different approaches to that are certainly valid and have worked in a number of different contexts. And I would love to read more in depth about that. So I think at this point, I am surprised that more people aren't writing about it.
Nobody holds back, though. I mean, it's all on Reddits or subreddits or anything else like that. And you have to fish for that sort of thing. And I think it's out there, but it's just like no one's going to collect it and put it in the book because they only have about 3 seconds worth of thought and opinion on it. and then it's over and they forget about it and it dips back into the web. But like, it's so I'm impressed. Like, I would have thought too, hey, you write a book about technology, what the fuck is the point? You know what I mean? Because, like, that technology is going to just become literally garbage probably within about 6 months to a year, depending upon updates. Things aren't going to be relevant anymore. And then you've got to kind of, like, do what most people do with the Bible nowadays, which is interpret. You know, so it's like, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, digital religion. You know what I mean? It's like, this is the way it used to be, and these are the old ways. But, like, it's so impressive to me that you wrote something that actually has sustained. Have you gone back into it and, like, shucked it and shucked it away enough to be like, okay, well, this is the stuff that's still relevant versus this is what's not? And do you have, like, a general percentage of what, like, you were gonna, because you said you're gonna do a second edition?
Yeah,
what are you leaving out? What are you updating?
It's it's nice to kind of go back and take a look at what I originally wrote and feel like most of it is still relevant. I would say probably 80 to 90% of it is still relevant.
Holy shit.
It's because a lot of those concepts are still the way I build websites. And so when I look at rewriting the book, it's actually not just like rewriting it.
It's appending.
Yeah, exactly. There is a lot more stuff that I want to add on. And a lot of that has been stuff that I've talked about in the workshops that I've been doing over the years, and it's stuff that hasn't really made its way back in. Because when I wrote the book, it was my experience at Yahoo. You know, when we were looking at, you know, how do we build something that could work well with multiple teams over multiple projects that needed to have a consistent look and feel. Because when I was building my own websites, I had my way of doing it, which worked well for me if I was the only person working on a project. And, you know, a couple months into working at Yahoo, realizing that that method of developing was no longer sustainable. And so writing the book was my way of documenting the different approach that we took to actually building a large project like that. And then to go into Shopify and realize, hey, you know what? These concepts still work well. They still work the same. But the technology over the years has changed. And so I see facets of it that I think are important. So, for example, in the book, naming convention was something that I was very prescriptive about. I said, like, here is the naming convention that I use. And a lot of that, the reason why I was prescriptive was because at the time, nobody was talking about naming convention.
Yeah, there was no conversation about patterns at all.
Yeah. And so since that time, I'm definitely not prescriptive. Like, the method that I show in the book, it feels comfortable to me, but I understand where it fails in certain situations. And I think that's the kind of stuff that I need to append to, the things that I want to shift, where it's the naming convention, I think, is still important. The actual naming convention that I use isn't. So, you know, whether or not you use a BEM style naming convention, whether you come up with your own, I think the core concept is, here is what you're naming and why you're naming it. And so come up with whatever naming convention you want, but here's the reason why you want to do that. And that's what I want to get back into the book.
So are you also going to add some things where maybe a few years ago you wouldn't think of doing a lot of kind of SaaS kind of things? Like, are you going to talk about extenders and why we avoid nesting, or why we should avoid nesting, or placeholder classes, ways to make debugging easier?
The I probably won't be going in too much into debugging. Some of the stuff around SAS and other preprocessors, I don't think my opinion has really changed that much over the years. I still, when I use SAS, keep it to a minimum, and there's like very specific concepts, very specific things that I'm trying to pull off, and those are the things that I care about. So like using extend is something that I pretty much avoid. But mix-ins under specific scenarios, functions, very specific scenarios, where essentially what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to create an API that allows consistency across the code base. Right? So I care about things, consistent maybe padding throughout the site, consistent colors being used throughout the site. And so I want that stuff centralized so that no matter where it's used, that stuff is going to be consistent. And mm-hmm. that centralization is usually done with variables or functions or mix-ins, things that enforce that consistency throughout a project. So those are, to me, are the more important things. And again, it's just about getting those concepts, because people don't need to necessarily use a preprocessor to pull that off. They can use any number of tools that can help that along. I think SAS is just certainly the most popular right now. Mm-hmm. But you know, in a couple of years, maybe it'll be something else.
That's interesting. What new technologies are you looking at? Like anything that you're excited about? I don't know if you're a more of a code kit or a terminal person, if you're a grunt or gulp person, if you're looking at React.
I feel like I'm a little old school in a couple ways. One, anytime I see a new technology come out, it feels very cyclical. You know, people will do the same thing over and over again, just in a slightly different way. And I'm not going to follow the next big thing all the time. In fact, a lot of my workflow is fairly simplistic. So I haven't used a lot of Gulp or Grunt or Webpack, except in the organizations that I've worked at. So when I worked at Shopify, we used Grunt. So I was familiar with Grunt in order to maintain that particular workflow. When I was at Xero, they were shifting a lot of the component development to, ES6, ES7 with Webpack, and so familiar with the workflow in that context. When I work on my own projects, my workflow is admittedly still really simplistic, and so there's not a lot of script runners that I run. I tend to hand code my CSS. I'll use some SAS compilation to bundle everything up, and then I have some Git workflows as far as using that to publish my stuff to my own sites. But I really need for me.
Any post CSS stuff?
I do like post CSS. And I'm trying to remember the name of it. Auto Prefixer.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Is by far my favorite, because it does allow the CSS to be simple. Because I think a lot of people used mix-ins to pull off the prefixing stuff. Like a lot of the stuff that Auto Prefixer does. And so we had implemented a lot of that stuff at Shopify, and I was really happy. It definitely simplified a lot of our CSS workflow. And there were opportunities where we were like, okay, we're no longer supporting these older browsers. Let me just modify that configuration, and boom, we would like lose a couple K off our CSS with a couple setting changes, which was always a delight.
What do you think about some of the CSS frameworks? Are you a fan of something like Foundation? Like Foundation has that really nice suite of for sites, apps, and emails. Do you use any of that, or Bootstrap, or anything?
Not at all. I'm artisanal CSS. I think that should be my tagline. Artisanal
I like that.
CSS.
That's nice.
I hand code everything from the first line to the very end. I don't use CSS resets. I want every bit of code that I'm writing to know that it's relevant and is solving the problem that I'm writing it for. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a good reason to be using those frameworks. I want to say like 10, 15 years ago, when I was doing a lot of backend development, I was coming in very much the same way, anti-framework, saying like, why would you ever use a framework? They're bloated, they're slow, they don't really help you in getting work done. If you've got your own libraries, these problems that you solved over and over again, just continue to build that library of tools for yourself. But then I quickly realized just that there's a lot of complexity. I think I was naive in that there is a lot of complexity in building an application, both back-end and front-end. Yeah. And these frameworks can speed up development. It's one of the reasons why I got into CakePHP so many years ago, was because I here was a library that, yeah, performance-wise, felt kind of slow. But my ability to get stuff done just went through the roof. There was a lot of automation in there that I liked, that sort of idea of convention over configuration that Ruby on Rails, skyrocketed on that concept, made a lot of sense to me. And so When I see people that use Bootstrap or Foundation or Suzy or whatever framework they want to use, I don't look down on that because it can really speed up development in a lot of their stuff that they're doing. I think it's just important to understand the trade-offs. On the back end, for the most part, you know, there are ways to speed up slow frameworks. So my site right now, it still uses CakePHP, but I think it's actually a pretty fast site. And the reason why is because, you know, I can put a lot of caching steps in there to speed up that development. On the front end, it's a lot harder. Like every framework that you pull in, there is likely a lot of unused code. And that unused code just doesn't disappear. It becomes a performance bottleneck for your users because they still have to download that. Their computers still have to process it, sure, even if it's not going to be used. And I think that problem, once it's been solved, is going to make front-end development more friendly to a lot of those frameworks.
Well, what about something like Foundation 6? So they claim that you do not have to download everything to use that. You could just use the parts that you want to use, just the grid system, for instance. You just do an include for that, and that's all you pull in. You don't need to pull in all the JavaScript files. You could just use something like that. So if, say if you're somebody that's just starting out, or if you're a nephew building a website for your uncle's company, would you say that that's a good place for you to just to get results?
It's better, but... you've included just the grid system, but most people's grid systems I find are still overly complex. They have like, you know, 20 to 40 classes for all these different scenarios. When for most sites that I've put together, my grid systems, I have maybe half a dozen classes at most. Mm-hmm. So is there a grid system that is going to be that fine tuned to my needs? Like, do I need... So let's say I have a 24 column grid system. Is anybody ever going to use all 24 classes? When I was at Shopify, we had that kind of grid system in place, and I did an audit and realized, one, a quarter of those classes were going completely unused. Another quarter of those classes were only being used once or twice. It was obvious that for pretty much all the layouts that we were doing, they come down to a fairly simple format. And any site that I've gone to, yes, they're using a quote-unquote 24-column grid or maybe a 16-column grid, but for the most part, their sites are two columns, three columns, or four columns.
Just very simple.
Very simple, right. And so they end up creating a lot of CSS that, again, still isn't being used. It's not necessary. And I like the simplicity of saying, okay, well, if I've got a two-column site, well, I need two classes. That's all I need. So I haven't seen a grid system that is that optimized to say, okay, I've included the grid system, but it won't generate anything until I've actually used those classes in very specific scenarios. And I know with SAS, like, we could say, let's create placeholder classes for all the different grid systems.
I was going to say, yep.
Are people using that stuff that well? And so there are possibilities for optimization. People have to understand how to use the tools in that way. But I find...
I'm laughing. I'm just because, yeah, you're right. I mean, if you're somebody that's just starting out, you're not going to know how to do that. You're just going to pull in like the full foundation and you're just going to use that, even though they do have placeholder classes and you could just pull in that placeholder class for those maybe the two things you use and that's it, not have all that excessive CSS. But if you're somebody just starting out, you A, don't know how to do that, and B, you should really understand what you're doing.
Yes. Yeah. You know, anybody that's coming into web development, I would really like it if they took the time to understand what, you know, vanilla JS is like, what vanilla CSS is like, even what vanilla HTML is like. You know, before you're getting into a lot of templating languages and stuff like that, understand the basics of the platform and then layer stuff in there, right? Understand that when I use jQuery, what are the benefits that it's giving me over this other stuff? Because in a lot of cases, people are pulling in a lot of stuff that just is not needed, right? Like if I think of my own site, do I need to pull in these libraries, and a lot of people like to use caching as this like, but it'll be cached, so I don't have to worry about the performance issues of that. And I don't think that that works. Or, you know, it's going to be gzipped, so it's only going to be 60K instead of 200K. And that's still 60K, and it's still a lot of JavaScript or CSS that the browser has to process. And why include that at all when I can hand code a script that might be 1K, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That is still going to beat out anything else. And so understanding the platform and understanding when to use those tools is important for every web developer out there.
Absolutely, because that gives you the appreciation for things like SAS. I couldn't imagine going back to vanilla CSS. Now, I don't know if you'll get the concepts of SAS if you just jump into it without looking at the results of it. Or if you don't know what DOM is and you're using jQuery, you're not going to be able to appreciate or get those concepts and maybe not debug properly if needed.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, the debugging process that a lot of people have to go through when, you know, they're dealing with 2-3 different layers of different frameworks, you know, generating a page, when if I can hand code something that I can keep it fairly simple. And, you know, browsers have thankfully improved dramatically over the recent years. And to know that a lot of the APIs that weren't there now are, that I can use, and they're fast. There's a lot of just consistency across platform is really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing I wanted to ask about your speaking. You do a lot of events. You go to a lot of conferences. What got you into doing that? Where did you find the inspiration that compelled you to start doing that?
It was similar to why I started writing for other organizations, was knowing that when I was freelance, I would need to get my name out there. So public speaking, seeing other people in the industry go to conferences, share their expertise, I saw an opportunity for myself to do the same thing. So in some ways, you know, I think a lot of people like to be very benevolent in saying like that they're going out there and they're sharing their knowledge and they can reach the largest audience. I'm going to be a little bit selfish and say that I went there because I wanted to get my name out there. I wanted people to be able to find the stuff that I was writing about, find the stuff that I was working on. And I think that has helped my career in that regard. And I think it's great that, you know, I've been able to share my approach, and that has resonated with people, that they've been able to take that those skills back to the work that they're doing and has improved their processes. And I like going to a conference and hearing how other people are building stuff. And it's a great way to talk to people, you know, not just listen to the talks, but talk to them after the talks and be able to dig into a little bit more about why they took a certain approach and how that worked for their team or teams, and pull that into the work that I'm doing so that I improve the way I work. And so I really like going to conferences for that reason.
You say that's a great way for people to start getting their names out. How does someone start doing that? Do you just have to find some kind of level of quote-unquote web celebrity fame before you could start speaking at conferences? Or is this something that you think everybody should just try to get their feet in the water and test out?
It's first of all, I think that in some ways our industry kind of shows this like career roadmap that like it starts off, you start developing, you start writing, and then you start speaking. And I don't think that is the necessary path that every web developer has to take. A lot of people don't care to get their name out there, and that's absolutely okay. You know, do the work you're doing. There are lots of ways to grow your career without ever going to a conference. There's a ton of material out there to read. That doesn't necessarily mean you need to write or put that stuff out there. With that said, if you do feel like that's a path that you want to get into, having some level of notoriety or celebrity isn't required. There's a lot of conferences that are looking for up-and-coming speakers. I can think of like CSS DevConf. They do a call for papers And people get to vote on the topics. And so they get a lot of new speakers where it's their first time on a stage, which is super helpful. There's a lot of local meetups. In Ottawa, for example, we have Style in Class. There's a CodePen meetup. There's Refresh Ottawa that I ran. So there's a lot of local organizations that they're not looking for notoriety. They're looking for people to present on a topic. And so if you have a topic you want to speak on, you can start local and then look at organizations that are looking for new speakers. And once you've gotten that level of work, then you can move on to larger, more curated conferences where you get invited to speak because you already have that body of work that shows your expertise, shows the topics that you're talking on, that you can further your career through that.
Yeah, I think some people fear critique as well, you know, and that'll keep them out of it. It's like, what if I say the wrong thing? Mm-hmm. Well, if you say the wrong thing, you may get an idea, or obviously you're going to have to sift through trolls, but there may be that nugget of inspiration that takes you into a different area. But I think that's great advice as far as speaking goes. I mean, just get yourself out there. Try. It's like stand-up comedy. It's like, just go to an open mic night and just try. Who cares if you're not funny? Just do it.
Yeah,
you'll hone it.
I think it's kind of sad, though, that you said that, like, they have to sift through trolls. And I think that's an unfortunate part of our industry, and I think one that I would like to curtail. For the most part, my perspective, you know, as a privileged white male, I recognize I don't really get a lot of flack for the kind of speaking I do. And I know there are definitely a lot of women and people of color who do, when they put themselves out there, do get flack because of the fact that they're women and people of color. And that's, I would love to see that shut down and see a lot more support of people from all walks of life and diversity being able to present the stuff that they're working on, because it's just as important as the stuff that I'm working on.
Yeah. I think what it is, and I think we'll close out with this thought, is that, and I've said it on other podcasts, we're a nation of people who have been raised by women now. I mean, like, most of us, I mean, don't have a lot of fathers that have stuck around, or we've been raised or been shown strong women in our everyday lives. I think we're poised for women in tech to be able to, and not just white women in tech, but all sort of women in tech, to be able to step up and have a platform and to have people get behind them, follow them, and believe in them. Because, hey, you know, the most important person in my life is my mom. So that's it. So that being said, you know, just let's discuss, you know. Jonathan, thank you so much, man, for coming on. It is a pleasure. I mean, Fred's been talking about it for forever. I always admit that, like, a lot of you guys, I don't necessarily know, but, like, I can always tell when Fred perks up and he's like, I could do this whole thing myself, that this was a good guest to have, you know what I mean? So thanks a lot for taking the time and forcing us to choose a new technology to play around with. It was good times.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.